Well, it is time for us to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a mostly sunny day today, with the winds from the east at 6 to 12 miles per hour, some patchy clouds tonight. Breezy tomorrow with a shower in places. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 65 with a low of 45, mostly sunny today, and again, patchy clouds tonight. Across the area, mostly sunny today. On a national basis, it was 95 degrees on Tuesday in Gila Bend, Arizona, and 14 in Daniel, Wyoming. And now let's take a look at the headlines in today's Des Moines Register on our front page. The Nature of the Beast: Why Are Police Across the Des Moines Metro Logging More Overtime? Also, AG wants to restart victim notification. The system sends updates on protective orders. And nationally, Trump judge hears arguments on gag order. And to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb. Take it away, Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. The Nature of the Beast: Why are police across the Des Moines Metro logging more overtime? For West Des Moines Police Department Sergeant Jason Bryan, driving traffic patrol on a Thursday afternoon in late March and working more than 40 hours for the week is just part of policing. But the rapid growth of Des Moines suburbs, with more people calling for help and more streets to patrol, coupled with continued staffing issues, have left some metro departments stretching their resources and officers. In the past 4 years, officers in four metro police departments, Clive, Johnston, Urbandale, and West Des Moines, together logged more than 35,000 hours of overtime, according to a Des Moines Register review of data from each department. Ankeny and Waukee, which reported figures in dollars, spent more than $767,700 combined on overtime from 2020 to 2023. You can try to do the best you can not to have a lot of overtime, but it's typically a regular occurrence, depending on the week or the time of year, Brian said. Every patrol shift needs a minimum level of staffing, so officers have backup, as well as handle calls for service, from car crashes to serious crimes. Every crime scene requires officers to stay until it's cleared. And officers get sick, take vacations or parental leave, or have to recover from injuries. That all leaves gaps, hours that have to be filled. It's just the nature of the beast, Brian said. But overtime can take a toll on police officers and their policing, increasing the risks that officers will be involved in lawsuits, be the subject of complaints, and resort to using force, as well as face a higher chance of injury, according to an inspection of the largest police department in the United States. The Register's analysis comes at a time when cities such as West Des Moines are weighing how to handle the stress of overtime. A recent consultant's report said overtime is taxing the city's officers and suggested reshuffling the department to reduce the hours its patrol officers work. As the COVID-19 pandemic reached Iowa in 2020 and people were stuck at home, many police departments saw a dip in calls for service. But there's only been an upward trend since, and police say that also has to do with the rapid growth of the suburbs, as well as the end of the pandemic. The six-county Des Moines Metro added more than 27,600 people from 2020 to 2023, growing to more than 737,000 residents and retaining its status as the fastest-growing large metropolitan area in the Midwest, according to U.S. Census data. Mandatory overtime costs or hours among suburban police departments in the metro grew even faster in some areas. From 2020 to 2023, Ankeny saw a 65% increase in mandatory overtime costs, and Waukee saw a 42% increase. During the same years in Johnston, there was a 91% increase in mandatory overtime hours, and in West Des Moines, a 97% increase. Spokespeople for the Dallas County Sheriff's Office and Altoona Police Department said their agencies do not mandate overtime. Polk County Sheriff's Office and Windsor Heights Police Department wanted to charge hundreds of dollars for an open records request on this overtime data. And the Des Moines Police Department did not respond to a request for mandatory overtime data. Growth in the number of people, homes, and businesses in an area generally means there are more calls for police to respond and more places to patrol. We have more people using Raccoon River Park. We have more people visiting our city for various entertainment venues. And we are a growing city, West Des Moines Police Chief Chris Scott said in an email. With growth, unfortunately, comes a certain percentage of problems. Another challenge of quick growth is that while in theory it means more tax revenue to allow departments to hire more officers, there's a lag between people moving in and businesses opening and revenue being realized in budgets, Brian said. You feel like you're kind of behind all the time, he said. And hiring is not so simple anymore. Brian, who supervises a special operations unit whose activities include hit-and-run and fatality crash investigations, bike patrols, and school resource officers, said there are a lot fewer applicants for open positions than there used to be. The U.S. Department of Justice noted last year that police departments nationwide faced a historic crisis in recruiting and retaining officers because of a tight labor market during the pandemic and community frustrations. Metro area departments were facing staffing issues years before the pandemic and fallout from the murder of George Floyd in May 2020 by a Minneapolis Police Department officer. And staffing continues to be a challenge that officials said is at least partly behind increases in overtime. In West Des Moines, a private consultant's analysis of the police department structure, workload, and staffing needs noted, the impact of the overtime that is often necessary to meet minimum staffing is taxing many members of the department. The report, conducted by Center for Public Safety Management, LLC, and presented to the West Des Moines City Council in February, also noted a majority of the department's traffic enforcement was being done with overtime shifts paid for by traffic safety grants, with a focus on speed and occupant safety violations. Brian said the Iowa Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau is available to pay overtime for a department's traffic enforcement, and that it allows his unit to get more done than it otherwise could. Funding overtime is a cost of services provided, Scott added. We could choose to cut our overtime activity, but that is a service reduction to our city, and the impact would be extremely negative. But is he worried about recent changes in state policies that will cap tax growth and challenge city budgets going forward, especially a city such as West Des Moines that is growing, which ultimately could mean his department would have more to do with less? The money's got to come from someplace, or some services might have to end, Scott said. The Center for Public Safety Management noted, the decision on how to properly staff patrol is the single largest management decision that should be made based on its report. While the consultant recommended that patrol staffing in West Des Moines be increased to better distribute workload and reduce overtime, quote, this recommendation falls short of recommending an overall increase in the size of the West Des Moines Police Department, end quote. Instead, the consultant suggested internally shifting officers or perhaps hiring civilian workers. Jenna Wilberding, spokesperson for Johnston, said in an email that staffing vacancies account for much of the overtime increase there. Typically, money saved from vacancies is transferred to pay for overtime, she said, but that still leads to tough cuts to programs, specialized things, or outreach initiatives. In 2023, we greatly reduced our summer bike patrol program hours due to limited staffing on patrol and using overtime funds to offset essential patrol services, Wilberding said. The spokesperson for the Ankeny Police Department and the chief of the Walk Gate Police Department said overtime costs have not strained their department's budgets. Still, overtime can stretch individual officers as well as their departments, and that can result in bad outcomes for officers and the communities they serve. A May 2023 report by the Office of the Inspector General for the New York City Police Department found that even 1 hour of overtime increased an officer's odds of being involved with negative policing outcomes, including lawsuits, civilian complaints of misconduct, use of force, vehicle crashes, and workplace injuries. Those odds continue to increase as an officer works more overtime hours consecutively, the report noted. The Urbandale Police Department has managed to scale back the number of overtime hours its officers have logged, despite a higher caller volume than before the pandemic and an ongoing staff shortage. It saw a huge increase to 348 overtime hours in 2020, from just 96 the year before. The department was back down to 132 hours last year. In general, our officers are not wanting to work overtime, so we do what we can to limit mandatory overtime by adjusting work schedules when needed to meet minimums on the department's 12-hour patrol shifts, Urbandale Police Chief Rob Johansson said. We have delayed increasing our minimum staffing on patrol, trying not to overwork our current officers, Johansson added. He said the department was down 10 officers in 2020 and 2021 because of resignations and retirements. The department is now down to 9 vacancies, and overtime still is being used to cover those open positions. Urbandale Police Department Officer Kelsey Stone, who is 2 years into her first position, said overtime is just part of the job to me. Brian, who has been in law enforcement full-time in the metro for 29 years, 26 of them in West Des Moines, said the amount of overtime he's working hasn't changed that much in recent years. He's learned some things to offer as advice for handling the physical and emotional demands of the job. You have to have hobbies outside work, as well as a strong personal network of family and friends and peer support within the department. Brian also said officers have to stay in shape physically and mentally, have to be able to listen to their bodies, and be able to ask for help when they need it. And don't forget the caffeine. Iced tea is his drink of choice.
Our next article on the front page, AG wants to restart victim notification. System sends updates on protective orders. Iowa officials are working to restart a long-shuttered notification system for domestic and sexual abuse victims who have protective or no-contact orders against their abusers. State law directs the Iowa Attorney General's Office to maintain a system to notify victims electronically or by phone when their protective orders are served on the abuser, and again 30 days before that order is about to expire. The notifications are meant to keep victims informed at what can be one of the most dangerous times for someone trying to leave a relationship. But the state discontinued the system in 2019 over reported problems with technical issues and data accuracy. Now officials are hoping to get it up and running again, a spokesperson for Attorney General Brenna Byrd confirmed to the Des Moines Register. Internal emails obtained through a records request show John Gish, chosen by Byrd to head the office's Victim Services Division after she took office last year, has been working since at least July of 2023 to resume victim notifications. The effort comes as Byrd's office continues to sit on a long-delayed review of Iowa's Crime Victim Services, which her office has previously cited in deciding to stop covering the cost of emergency contraception for rape victims. Before 2019, victims received automatic notifications through the Iowa Vine Protective Order Notification for Domestic Abuser System, or IPONDA. According to the system's vendor, EPRIS, the system was discontinued that year because of issues with some of the data, Gish wrote in an email last year. He wrote that he hoped a new version of the system would be successful, in part because of updates to EPRIS's software. Spokeswoman Alyssa Brolet confirmed the Attorney General's office is working to restart notifications. She did not give an estimate for when the system would be ready, but said the state expects to pay an initial cost of $338,000 and an annual fee of approximately $200,000 thereafter. Research has shown that domestic violence victims are most at risk when trying to leave their partners, such as by obtaining protective orders. And Brolet says the system will give victims crucial information to try to keep themselves safe. As a prosecutor, Attorney General Byrd recognizes that every second counts when it comes to protecting victims, she said. Establishing a new protective order system will alert victims and buy them critical time when law enforcement serve protective orders to their abusers. Kristen Feisel, director of the training for the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, said restarting notifications may be a good investment. HIPONDA could be a huge bang for your buck if it could be one of those things that does a great deal of good very efficiently and cheaply, she said, noting that funding is also urgently needed for direct victim services. Margaret Acosta-Werick, a senior attorney with the Iowa Legal Aid, said restarting victim notifications would help many of the organization's clients. It may help or may remind people to apply early for an extension of a protective order when warranted, she said. Also, if victims know when their protective order has been served, they are able to know that it has been violated and can take appropriate actions to keep themselves safe in situations where every minute counts. Janelle Melon, who led the Crime Victim Assistance Division at the time HIPONDA shut down, declined to comment specifically on the issues that arose with the original system, noting that she continues to work with both the Iowa Attorney General's Office and APRIS in her role with the U.S. Department of Justice. But she described via email the serious technical and organizational hurdles confronting a program that would need to synthesize inputs from more than 250 law enforcement agencies, 99 county attorneys, and various county court systems, all of which would rely on staff promptly entering data on new protection orders. Melon said she personally saw the importance of keeping victims informed early in her career while working for the Story County Jail. We released a man who had been arrested for simple domestic assault the night prior, and he showed up at the door of the victim's house within 15 minutes of his release, Melon said. I was distracted by more work and forgot to make the notification call. Although the man in that case was arrested before harming the victim again, Melon said the experience led her to spearhead efforts to create automated systems for Story County and later statewide. Prompt, accurate notice is vital. I commend the Iowa Attorney General's Office and the State Court Administrator's Office if they have found a way to ensure that all of these moving pieces can be culled from Iowa systems, resulting in consistent, accurate, and timely notifications to victims, she told the Register. One of Byrd's first actions after taking office in January of 2023 was to order a top-down and bottom-up audit of victim services, with Gish named to lead the effort. Up to that point, the only apparent result of the audit process was Byrd's decision to pause reimbursements to medical providers for sexual assault victims' emergency contraceptives. The payments, which are not explicitly required by law, were a long-standing practice under her predecessor, Democrat Tom Miller. But Byrd paused the payments and told Iowa PBS last year she intends to make any policy change permanent. In the years since, some medical providers have chosen to take on the costs themselves, while some local governments have stepped in to provide reimbursements in their jurisdictions. In a July of 2023 email, Gish ties the efforts to resume HIPONDA alerts to the ongoing review. One of the issues I identified in the audit was the lack of protective order notification system for victims of sexual abuse or domestic abuse who are protected parties, he wrote to Iowa victim advocates.
Trump judge hears arguments on gag order. The sixth day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial started with arguments over whether the former president should be held in contempt for allegedly violating a gag order, and then tumbled into the tawdry world of tabloids. Prosecutors say Trump has violated the gag order at least 10 times, and the judge should not only fine the presumptive Republican presidential nominee $1,000 per violation, but warn him he could get jail time if things don't change. In the first criminal trial of a former or current president, Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Prosecutors say he tried to cover up unlawfully interfering in the 2016 presidential election through a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. The gag order forbids Trump from commenting on jurors, potential witnesses, court staff, and family members of Judge Juan Merchan and District Attorney Alvin Bragg. He may respond to political attacks. At the Tuesday hearing, Prosecutor Christopher Conroy detailed each allegation violation. Many involved Trump going after Michael Cohen, a potential witness. Moreover, Conroy said, Trump again attacked Cohen Monday by telling reporters outside the courtroom that his former personal lawyer got caught lying, pure lying, in a previous trial. Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanche defended the client's statements, saying he's allowed to respond to political attacks, Your Honor. The judge appeared to grow frustrated after Blanche did not provide specific examples of the attacks to which Trump was said to be responding. The judge said Blanche had neither case law nor evidence to back up his argument. You presented nothing, Marchand said. I've asked you 8 or 9 times, show me the exact post he was responding to. You've not even been able to do that once. He added, you're losing all credibility with the court. The judge did not immediately rule on the gag order. During a break, Trump ignored reporters' questions on whether he will be posting on Truth Social or if his lawyer has credibility. Instead, he posted, this is a kangaroo court and the judge should recuse himself. Then media executive David Pecker retook the witness stand. He met Trump at Mar-a-Lago in the late 80s, Pecker said, and developed a great relationship. Trump was very helpful introducing Pecker to other media people. He was knowledgeable and very detail-oriented, almost a micromanager, Pecker said, also very frugal. Pecker was the president and CEO of National Enquirer's parent company, American Media Incorporated, in August 2015, when he met with Trump and Cohen. According to a Federal Election Commission agreement with the company, Pecker helped, quote, deal with the negative stories about Trump by purchasing them and not publishing them, a practice known as catch and kill. In Tuesday's testimony, Pecker confirmed that with details. He described a meeting about what his magazines could do to help the Trump campaign. Knowing that the Trump organization had a very small staff, Pecker promised to be its eyes and ears. If he heard anything negative about Trump or anything about women selling stories, he would notify Cohen, and did. Cohen would then have the stories killed, Pecker testified. The agreement, Pecker told Cohen, had to be highly confidential. When Trump announced his bid, Pecker expected that a number of women would try to sell their stories because Trump was, quote, well known as the most eligible bachelor and dated the most beautiful women, he said. It was common for women to call up a place like the National Enquirer to try to sell their stories during someone's political run, he said. The plan also included Cohen planting negative stories about Trump's opponents. The lawyer would call Pecker up, on Trump's behalf it seemed, and say, we would like for you to run a negative article on a certain political opponent. Then Cohen would send information about, say, Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or Marco Rubio. We would embellish it from there, Pecker said. One example, a story from March 2016 entitled, in all caps, Ted Cruz Sex Scandal, 5 Secret Mistresses. As Roll Call reported at the time, Cruz vehemently denied the allegation, and no one except for Trump associate Roger Stone presented any evidence that the Texas senator had misbehaved. Pecker also gave an example of a negative story that surfaced about Trump. Dino Sajurgin, a doorman at Trump Tower, was looking to sell a story about Trump allegedly fathering a child with a maid. I immediately called Michael Cohen, Pecker said. Cohen replied that the story is absolutely not true, but said he would check it out, according to Pecker. Sajurgin's story has been widely questioned. He claimed only to have been told about the child, and the New Yorker uncovered no evidence that Trump fathered the child. Trump has denied Sajurgin's story. If it had been true, it would have been the biggest National Enquirer story since the death of Elvis Presley, Pecker said. And Cohen agreed that the Enquirer could publish it after the 2016 presidential election. However, in investigating the story, Pecker's team concluded the story was completely untrue. Pecker said he still paid $30,000 to keep it from getting out through another media outlet and hurting the Trump campaign. Cohen thanked him, adding, "The boss will be very pleased." What was in it for Pecker? The Apprentice was helpful to Pecker's magazines because the audience for the National Enquirer and other celebrity magazines follow Trump religiously, Pecker said. Jury proceedings ended at 2 p.m. for the Passover holiday. Though the trial is not televised, New York courts announced Monday they would publish daily transcripts of the proceedings to the New York State Unified Court System's press website by the end of the following business day.
Moving from now to the Metro and Iowa section, we'll go right into our first story, Come On Over, the story behind Adventureland's iconic ad jingle. Come on over to Adventureland, you're going to have a fun-filled day. You know the song, you might even know the words. For years, Adventureland's commercial jingle ruled the airwaves. The seconds-long song, which debuted in the middle to late 1980s on TV and radio ads, became a summer fixture for Iowans, much like their days spent at the Altoona Amusement Park. But what else is there to know about the tune? Well, it starts with Rick Condon at Triad Studios. Longtime Des Moines musician and recording engineer Rick Condon produced the legendary jingle, which briefly was taken off the air in 2021, as the amusement park faced new ownership. Adventureland, Iowa's largest theme park, celebrated its 50th milestone anniversary this year and was sold to Palace Entertainment, the U.S. subsidiary of global theme park operator Parques Reunidos. Palace Entertainment bought the familiar song, brought the familiar song back during the summer of 2022, along with a new ad to promote the park's newest ride at the time, the Flying Viking. Alex Payne, Regional Public Relations Manager for Palace Entertainment, said the company plans to include the song as a large part of our brand in the future. In 1985, Condon was named Chief Engineer at Triad Studios in Des Moines, a period in his life where he says he hit a professional stride and cemented his role in the city's music scene. Condon, now 73, said he first joined Triad in 1974 to help run the company's secondary studio. He was then 24 and shifting away from his band, Salt River. Condon said an ad agency approached him sometime in the mid-1980s with a request to revamp Adventureland's original banjo-heavy number. He remembered they wanted something more like Disney and less hokey. Condon's first idea was to get a huge orchestra. Then he hired Dwayne Funderburk, a pianist and composer he had often collaborated with, to craft the arrangement. Funderburk, who lived in Des Moines with his wife from 1985 to 1992, said he met Condon at Triad. They began working together, he recalls, after Condon learned of his love for writing music. Funderburk, age 70, who settled in California after his stint in Iowa, remembered Condon wanted the new jingle to be lively. He wanted this to be really fun jingle with some energy to it, Funderburk said about Condon's vision. We knew enough about Iowa. We knew enough about how much Adventureland meant to a lot of people. We worked really hard to create a fun, energetic piece of music. Somewhere between 20 to 30 singers and musicians, including those from the Des Moines Symphony, were brought on to bring the upbeat, brass-dominant track to life, Condon and Funderburk said. Condon said he couldn't have predicted that his Adventureland ad jingle would take off the way it did and have the shelf life that it did. Had I known that was going to last that long, I would have charged them more, he joked. The bill came out to $4,000. That's about $12,000 in today's dollars. Funderburk shared a similar response. No, he said, reflecting on the longevity of the Adventureland song Condon produced. Music changes so fast, but what's happened is people got this song in their mind when we first created it, he added. And that's what they heard every time they saw the Adventureland commercial. It's really catchy, and people remember it. Condon also helped produce catchy jingles years later, for Drake Diner and a local Chevrolet dealership. On producing music for the diner, Condon remembered the no-frills restaurant at Drake University's campus had a slogan, "Where You Want to Be." Condon said he was asked to create three different versions of one jingle. It had to come in country, rock, and R&B. The song didn't have a message. The sound needed to be distinct enough for people to associate the college spot with it. It was a tall order, but one Condon said he completed. Condon said he enlisted the help of Warren Rogers, a local pastor in the Des Moines Metro, with the R&B version. He also tapped then Iowa Public Television host Morgan Helgren to assist with the diner's punk rock version. He had a particular vision for Helgren. Condon wanted Helgren's screechy, olive oil-style voice to tower over the chorus to get that brash sound. She was an actress, and she had 100 voices that she could do, Condon said, as he went over Hellgren's body of work and areas of expertise. Among the stories Condon told the Register, there's one that stood out. Years ago, Condon said he was hired to produce a song that went along with a presentation for a former Maytag CEO who was scheduled to speak at a major conference. It was in the mid-1990s, and the movie Space Jam, which featured Chicago Bulls legend Michael Jordan and other NBA stars such as Larry Bird, Larry Johnson, and Patrick Ewing, was popular then, and the hit song from that film was R. Kelly's I Believe I Could Fly. Condon said he read over the president's speech and saw it echoed the same messages of possibility, of bravery, and self-belief as I Believe I Could Fly. What he knew for certain was that he was going to bring a full orchestra. The rest was still unwritten. Condon said he was stumped and didn't have anything to share up until the day before he was making his pitch. He got in the shower and minutes later came out with a song. This is how my whole music career has gone, frankly, he said while laughing. I got in the shower one morning, and by the time I got out of the shower, I had completely written a song and sat down at the piano. Right?
Investigators seek motive in double slayings. A man who was arrested and charged with murdering two people in rural Mercer County became upset when two victims began speaking Spanish before the fatal shooting, court documents said. Elias Juan Lasky, Elias Julian Lasky, 29, was taken into custody in the 4700 block of Merle Hay Road in Des Moines on April 19th in the slaying of Mario Murillo and Francis Tillegasca, 33, of Marshalltown. Marshalltown County Sheriff's Office deputies were dispatched to 2645 182nd Street for a welfare check on the occupants of the home at 1:45 a.m. on April 19th, according to a news release from the Marshall County Sheriff's Office. Murillo's brother had reported that he had not heard from him since 4 p.m. on April 18th, according to court documents. When deputies arrived, they found Murillo and Gasca dead. Investigators found multiple gun shell casings at the scene, court documents said. Deputies used tattoos to identify the victims. Witnesses told deputies that three acquaintances, including Lasky, showed up to a small gathering where Murillo and Gasca were present, according to court documents. A witness told investigators that Lasky initially had become upset when Murillo and Gasca started to speak Spanish at the gathering, court documents said. The witness said Murillo and Gasca left the house to a car where Lasky followed them. The witness told investigators Lasky pulled out a gun and shot Murillo and Gasca, according to court documents. He saw Gasca fall to the ground and Lasky leave the scene. Investigators are still trying to ascertain the relationship between the two victims and Lasky, Sheriff Joel Phillips told the Register. We don't know exactly the relationships they had between each other, but they were all known as associates. That's what we can establish at this time, Phillips said. The incident remains under investigation by the Marshall County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, Phillips said. We couldn't have any more help from the public, Phillips said. It was instrumental in this case to be able to identify the location of Mr. Lasky. Investigators are still trying to determine why Lasky shot Murillo and Gasca, Phillips said. And a homicide suspect has history of abuse against the victim. A Des Moines man who was arrested Friday for the alleged beating death of his girlfriend has a history of abuse against her, court documents reveal. Derek A. Ernest, 60, was charged with first-degree murder in the death of 49-year-old Holly Hudson Snodgren of Pleasant Hill early Friday morning. He is in custody on a $1 million bond in the city's third homicide of 2024. Police first heard of Snowgren's injuries at 3 a.m. when Ernst took her to a local hospital. Hospital officials contacted police because of the extent of her injuries, which are believed to be from blunt force trauma. While at the hospital, Ernst allegedly told police that he was contacted by an unidentified party and told where the victim was at, whom he identified as a girlfriend, court documents say. Ernest provided the approximate location of the crime scene in the alley behind 1129 14th Place. While the Des Moines Police Department Crime Scene Investigation Unit searched the scene for evidence early Friday morning, they found a surveillance camera that discounted his claims. According to court documents, video recordings with both audio and video evidence show the defendant, identifiable by clothing worn in the incident and still worn while in contact with the police, assaulting the victim and shouting threats of further violence. Defendant Ernest appears to strike the victim multiple times with a large piece of lumber that was recovered at the scene of the assault while threatening to kill her, the documents say. The video allegedly shows Ernest dragging Snowden away after about 8 minutes. She died at the hospital. A search warrant application shows on September 19, 2023, Ernest was accused of domestic abuse against Snowden. Charges were dropped after Snowden was uncooperative, the warrant says. Ernest also allegedly sent threatening text messages to Snowden's parents. The warrant indicates the messages made statements of physical injury to their daughter. Ernest has multiple previous charges of assault, drug possession, theft, forgery, and driving while barred. His initial hearing in this case is scheduled for April 30th.
Ex-pro board member suit tossed. Judge rules employment protections don't apply. A former member of the Iowa's Board of Parole is not protected by state whistleblower laws and cannot sue over the loss of her position, a judge has found. Kathleen Kuiker of Osceola served from 2018 to 2021 on the board, which makes decisions about when Iowa prisoners who have completed a minimum sentence may be granted parole. Members are appointed by Governor Kim Reynolds, but in 2021, Reynolds declined to reappoint Kuiker at the conclusion of her term. In a lawsuit filed in 2023, Kuiker alleged she had been denied reappointment because she'd spoken up about potentially illegal actions by the board and its then-chair, Helen Miller. In her complaint, she describes a range of alleged mismanagements by Miller, a longtime Democratic state representative from Fort Dodge, most notably that she had permitted some parole decisions to be made by a panel solely of the board's three alternate members in violation of state law. Kuiker said she brought her concerns repeatedly to Reynolds and the Iowa Attorney General's office, but got little or no response. Attorneys for the state moved to dismiss Kuiker's suit, and earlier this month, a Polk County judge agreed. The issue, Judge David Porter wrote, is that the whistleblower laws Kuiker cites in her complaint draw a distinction between employees and the officers of the state. Pro-board members, Porter found, clearly fall in the latter category and aren't afforded the same protections as regular state employees. The employment protections granted to employees by virtue of the master-servant relationship they enter with employers far surpass the employment protections public officials enjoy, Porter wrote in dismissing Kuiker's claims. Kuiker, a retired magistrate judge, said in a statement that Porter's decision points to what she calls a loophole in the law that allows some members of Iowa's executive branch to be considered above the law, unaccountable under the law for misappropriation of funds, violating the rights of inmates and victims, tampering with records, filing false reports, and punishing whistleblowers. This is now a cautionary tale to any other state employees who can also be classified as, quote, officers. Do not report or try to stop illegal actions you witness at your board. Just be complicit if you want to keep your job, or if you plan to apply for reappointment, she said. While the lawsuit is over, Kuiker said she will be happy to meet with legislators to discuss what she saw as violations of the law during her time on the board. In an email, Kuiker estimated that an illegally constituted panel of the parole board made parole decisions in the cases of about 250 inmates. In her lawsuit, she alleged that regular board members had later gone back and added their votes to decisions made by the three alternates in an attempt to make them retroactively appear legal. It's not clear whether any of those denied parole by a possibly illegal panel had challenged their decisions in court. In February, State Auditor Rob Sand released a report on the board noting he had sought records related to Kuiker's allegations, but that the board had denied his request, citing a recent state law limiting the auditor's authority. Meanwhile, the problem appears unlikely to arise again. The legislature in 2023 rescinded the statute requiring at least one member of each parole board decision panel to be a permanent member.
From brews to extruders, 67 products have been nominated for the coolest thing made in Iowa. Take a ride on a trolley, play a round of golf in a cart fashion like a classic street rod. Enjoy the outdoors in a camping van, or just sit back at home and enjoy a craft beer or a gourmet ice cream sandwich. Each of these products is nominated for the title of Coolest Thing Made in Iowa. Now it's up to Iowans to determine which of the 67 nominees takes the crown. The contest, sponsored by the Iowa Association of Business and Industry and Midwest One Bank, also counts among its contenders noodles, cotton candy, tiki bar boats, and explosion-proof electric engines. The competition moved to the popular round vote on Monday and runs through April 30th, when the nominees will be pared down to a 6-Sweet 16 bracket. To vote, go to coolestthingia.com. Here's the remaining schedule for the contest. May 1st, the top 16 are announced. May 2nd to 8th, final round of voting. May 9th, top 8 announced. May 10th to 16th, second round of voting. May 17th, the top 4 are announced. May 20th to 29th, final round of voting. And on June 5th, the winner will be announced at AFBI's Taking Care of Business Conference. This marks the first year Iowa has offered the contest, joining nearly 20 other states. The contest gives ABI and Midwest One the opportunity to spotlight a big component of Iowa's economy, manufacturing. It accounts for more than 17% of the gross state product and in excess of 14% of Iowa's employment. That's 225,000 workers and over $38 billion in economic output in 2021, according to the National Association of Manufacturers. Here's a full list of nominees. 2000 GC Extruder from Minster Pro International, Grimes. 75 Pro Series Bait Rack, Creek Bank Tanks of Corning. Aero 59 Series NASCAR Wheel, Aero Race Wheels, Incorporated of Esterville. Any Flow Yard Hydrant from Merrill Manufacturing in Storm Lake. Artisan Baked Goods Display Boxes, Big River Packaging in Clinton. Atlas Bladesmith Forge of Atlas Knife and Tool, Neltona. Bin Buster Hazy IPA from Tatanka Brewing Company in Tatanka. Blue Bunny Mini Swirls, Wells Enterprises, Lamar's. Brent Avalanche 2598 from Brant and Shell Rock. Bulldog Honey Kolsch, Confluence Brewery from Des Moines. Butter Braid Pastries, Country Made Incorporated, West Bend. Coca-Cola Classic, Atlanta Bottling Company, Atlanta. Conductor Rail, Conductix Wampler in Harlan. Custom Built Pipe Organ, Dobson Pipe Organ Builders Limited, Lake City. Dandelion Wine, Ackerman Winery, Marengo. Deals Orchard Hard Cider, Deals Orchard, Jefferson. DRI 12, Deep Rooted Irrigation in West Burlington. Easy Eddie from Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. Explosion Proof Electric Motor from Bodine Electric Company in Peosta. F530 Farm Skid from Appanoose Manufactured Products in Moulton. Fiberglass Pedal Boats, K Park Recreation, Janesville. Gourmet Dog Treats, Woofables, the Gourmet Dog Bakery in Coralville. Gushers, General Mills, Cedar Rapids. High Speed Disc Blade, Osmond Manufacturing Company, Perry. HSP 1 from Industrial 3D Printer from Heart Smart Products in Urbandale. iHydrant, Smart Fire Hydrant, Clow Valve Company, Oskaloosa. Inception Electric Fireplace, Hearth and Home Technologies, Mount Pleasant. Industrial Conveyor Parts Washer, Precision Metalworks, Maquoketa. Insulated Bearing Bib DI-200, Dixon Industries Incorporated, Des Moines. Iris Circadian Sky Ceiling, Sky Factory, Incorporated, Fairfield. Jackson Knobs from Jackson Manufacturing, Incorporated in Maquoketa. KLIMB Dog Training Platform, Blue Nine Pet Products, Maquoketa. Craig Pocket Hole Jig 320, Craig Tool, Huxley. Lifeline Ambulance, Lifeline Emergency Vehicles, Incorporated, Sumner. Marshalltown Hamburger Trowel, Marshalltown Tools, Marshalltown. Max Mobile LED Trailer, Insane Impact, Des Moines. MCG Bio Plant Markers, MCG Bio Composites, LLC, Minnetonka. Meal Meter 2.0 from Pig Easy, LLC, in Templeton. Medium and Line Board Paper, International Paper, Cedar Rapids. Mold for Injection Molding, MSI Mold Builders, Cedar Rapids. Nevis Noodles, Nevis Noodles, LLC, in Sheraton. OTR Tire Service Truck, Stellar Industries, Garner. Over the Ivy, Czech Style Pilsner, Confluence Brewing Company, Des Moines. Percival Scientific Controlled Environment Room, Percival Scientific Incorporated, Perry. Power Tower, EFCO Corporation, Des Moines. Ranch Cotton Candy, Chocolate Storybook, DBA Fairy Tale Cotton Candy, Des Moines. S975 Express Plus Soft Mount Washer, Dexter Laundry, Fairfield. Safe Tea Home, Sukup Manufacturing in Sheffield. Sea and Spray, John Deere, Ankeny. Shoe Ute, Jungetart, LLC, in Haywarden. Single Barrel, Straight Bourbon, Century Farms Distillery in Spencer. Smart Fence Alarm, Insulites, Akron. Sports Lighting, Musco Lighting, Oskaloosa. Street Broad Golf Carts, Street Broad Golf Cars, in Montezuma. The Iowa Candle, from Candle Creek Farms in Mallard. Thelma's Ice Cream Sandwich, from Thelma's in Des Moines. Tiki Bar Boats, from Big Huts in Princeton. Tillman's Small Batch Whiskey, Wildcat Distilling, Duncombe. Tomato Slicer, Random Manufacturing Company, Waverly. Transmissions and Torque Converters, Fort Dodge Transmission, Fort Dodge. Trolley Car, Gomaco Trolley, Mida Grove. Vermeer ZR5 1200 Self-Propelled Baler, Vermeer Corporation, Pella. Volumetric Concrete Mixer, Seaman Industries, Indianola. Warren Lift, Microway LLC in Burlington. Wilcox All-Pro 202s from Wilcox All-Pro Incorporated in Montezuma. Winnebago Rebel, Winnebago Industries, Lake Mills. And World's Best Cat Litter from Cat Corporation in Muscatine.
And last piece of Iowa news, Altoona unveils first-of-its-kind amenity at Spring Creek Park. Altoona launched a first-of-its-kind amenity on Monday that got the mayor on the water. City officials staged a ribbon cutting for the new boat ramp and launch on the south pond of Spring Creek Park, near the intersection of Northwest 80th Street and 30th Street Southeast. The launch is a track that lets riders in small boats, such as a kayak or a canoe, propel themselves into the water with handles on each side. The launch makes it easier to get in and out of the water, including for people with disabilities. Mayor Dean O'Connor demonstrated how to use the launch in a small blue kayak at the event on Monday. He said ahead of the launch that there will be future phases to add trails, fishing piers, and other recreational amenities. The boat launch project was partially funded by a $20,000 Prairie Meadows grant. The public is welcome to use the boat dock, launch, and ramp to fish and enter the water. The South Pond is up to 45 feet deep in some places and has a variety of fish, including catfish, bluegill, bass, and crappie. According to a news release, boats with gas engines are not allowed on the pond. Excuse me. Turn over now to some national news. College campuses see more protests. Columbia classes going virtual for student safety. Protests resumed Tuesday near New York University as colleges across the nation braced for more unrest after days of demonstrations, campus closures, and arrests swirling around U.S. support for Israel in its war on Hamas. Dozens of protesters were arrested Monday during a pro-Palestinian demonstration at Yale University in Connecticut and New York University in Manhattan. Hundreds of students at Stanford University in Northern California held a walkout, while students at the University of California, Berkeley, erected a Free Palestine encampment. Students at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor set up a protest camp with banners that read, "Encampment for Gaza, Divest Now, and Long Live the Intifada." Education Secretary Miguel Cardona called for calm in a social media post Tuesday, saying universities are at their best when they promote the respectful exchange of diverse views and constructive debate. The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights interpreted the civil rights laws it enforces consistent with free speech and other First Amendment rights, he said. But we won't tolerate hate or harassment that targets students because of who they are or who they're perceived to be. New York University's Manhattan campus was quieter Tuesday after pro-Palestinian demonstrations led to scores of arrests a day earlier. Outside the Stern School of Business, cameras were trained on a set of barricades while a man held a sign reading, "Israel kills 1,400 kids." Nearby, Nikhil Chirumala, 21, a senior studying dramatic writing, looked on. He said he chose not to get involved in Monday's protests when he spotted police in riot gear. "I feel like the university's response is or was a bit dramatic. I think it was peacefully protested," Chirumala said, adding that the university is clear on their position on the matter. They're not as open to pro-Palestinian voices on campus. New York University President Linda Mills said she brought in police after protesters breached barriers with disorderly, disruptive, and antagonizing behavior that interfered with the safety and security of our community. She said many refused to leave. But New York University's Professor Association issued a statement Tuesday calling much of the account false and blasted the administrator for bringing in the police. The statement said the protest was loud, but there was no intimidation, other than by New York Police Department, which the group said made arrests in an especially rough manner and pepper sprayed a student who was taking pictures. NYPD did not respond immediately to USA Today's request for comment. A New York University protest kicked off later in the afternoon in Lower Manhattan's Washington Square Park, a quasi-center for university life. Off to the side of the park's famous fountain, a group of speakers led a medium-sized crowd in chants like, "Linda Mills, you're a liar." They also instructed those in attendance not to speak to reporters who weren't vetted. "We had members, faculty, who were arrested last night because management turned the New York Police Department on peacefully demonstrating students and faculty, which they then disingenuously justified by saying that they were outside agitators," said Charles Gelman, 36, an adjunct faculty member at NYU. Many signs read UAW for permanent ceasefire over the backdrop of the Palestinian flag. The Academics Come Together, United Auto Workers Local 7902, represents more than 4,000 adjunct professors, educators, and healthcare workers at NYU and the New York School, and the new school, its website says. In part, "We are trying to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian trade unions who have called for support from fellow unions intentionally to do what we can do to stop the flow of weapons, especially from the United States to Israel, that are destroying homes, families, and lives in Gaza and in the West Bank," said Gelman, who is a union member. New York's Columbia University, the epicenter of the demonstrations, announced Tuesday that classes will provide a virtual learning option, where technology permits, until spring semester ends on May 10th. Student protesters inside the Columbia encampment barred the media from entering the space, and university administrators told USA Today it was up to students whether to allow reporters in. Last week, Columbia University President Menachi Shafik trekked to Washington to face a salvo of tough questions from Republican lawmakers about reports of anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus. While Shafik was in Washington, students set up protest camps at the center of campus and demanded the university sever all ties to Israel. The following morning, Shafik called in New York City police to clear up the demonstrators, and officers arrested more than 100 people. Members of the Columbia's Department of Sociology say they were alarmed by the university's actions. Police have said there was no credible threat to safety from the campus protests. The group issued a statement Tuesday saying the suspension of students arrested was irregular, unnecessary, and resting on shaky legal ground. The educators called on the school to reverse the suspension and allow students to return to the campus and to classes. "For our own part, as members of the faculty of the Department of Sociology, we will continue to keep our courses open to these students. We will grade their exams and their papers, and we will give them final grades in our courses so they may receive credit," the statement said.
millions more Americans to be eligible for overtime. The Biden administration on Tuesday announced a new rule that would make millions of white-collar workers newly eligible for overtime pay. Starting July 1st, the rule would increase the threshold at which executive, administrative, and professional employees are exempt from overtime pay to $43,880 from the current $35,568. That change would make an additional 1 million workers eligible to receive time-and-a-half wages for each hour they put in beyond a 40-hour week. On January 1st, the threshold would rise further to $58,656, covering 3 million more workers. Quote, this rule will restore the promise to workers that if you work more than 40 hours in a week, you should be paid for that time, Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu said in a statement. So often, lower-paid salary workers are doing the same job as their hourly counterparts, but are spending more time away from their families for no additional pay. This is unacceptable. The new standard fulfills one of President Joe Biden's signature objectives of raising the wage of low- and middle-class Americans, and it comes within months of his face-off with former President Donald Trump in the November election. For years, Biden and Democrats in Congress have proposed raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour, but have been blocked by Republican lawmakers. Last summer, the Labor Department proposed lifting the salary threshold for exempt employees to about $55,000, but updated the benchmark in the final rule after receiving more than 33,000 public comments. While hourly workers are generally entitled to overtime pay, salaried workers are not if they earn above a certain pay level and supervise other workers, use professional expertise or judgment, or hire and fire workers, among other duties. The new standard could be legally challenged by industry groups that have argued that excessively raising the standard exceeds labor's authority and adds heavy regulatory and financial burdens or compliance costs. Quote, this rule is another costly hoop for small business owners to jump through, Beth Benito, executive director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses Small Business Legal Center, said. Some companies could lift workers' base pay to the new threshold to avoid paying overtime, or convert salaried workers to hourly employees who need to punch a clock. Others could instruct salaried employees to work no more than 40 hours a week, bringing on part-time workers to pick up the slack. The initial bump in the salary threshold to $43,880 that takes effect July 1st is based on a Trump administration formula that sets it at the 20th percentile of the full-time weekly earnings of salaried employees in the lowest wage region, which is currently the South. The increase to $58,656 on January 1st adopts a new formula that sets a threshold at the 35th percentile of those weekly earnings. Starting July 1st, 2027, the rule requires labor to adjust the salary threshold every 3 years to account for updated wage data.
And here's some state breaks, the first one from Iowa. Announcement that Daisy will be building a $627 million dairy processing plant in Iowa will translate to more than just added jobs and increased financial investment. It will mean more cows. Daisy will need the output of an estimated 43,000 dairy cows to meet its daily production requirements, the president of the Ames Chamber of Commerce said. From Topeka, Kansas, education officials estimate that every day in Kansas, about 1,000 drivers illegally pass a stopped school bus as it picks up or drops off children. But with the legislature not acting on a proposal to help law enforcement crack down on violators of the state stop arm law, the Kansas State Board of Education is pursuing a regulatory change in an attempt to make it safer when loading or unloading a school bus. And from Carson City, Nevada, a new report says American families that pay for child care spend nearly one-fifth of their income on the service, and the costs are rising. In Nevada, the costless child care state, families spend 32.3% of their income on average of $493 a week for others to watch their children, the report says.